Good evening and welcome to Chicago Tonight Latino Voices. I'm Joanna Hernandez on the show tonight. The Chicago Public Schools Board approves a balanced budget for next year, but future worries remain. Advocacy groups are calling for action after domestic violence deaths in Illinois spiked last year.
They've made this very difficult process a lot easier.
How a local organization is helping families affected by gun violence. And a public art exhibit uncovering the history of an ancient Mexican civilization. And now to some of today's top stories. The Secret Service, along with top city officials, say they are fully prepared for next month's Democratic National Convention in Chicago. Today, they made public the security maps outlining the perimeters of both the United Center and McCormick Place. Officials say these maps will be distributed to residents and businesses, detailing the restricted areas and checkpoints for pedestrians and vehicles. A Secret Service official says the DNC safety plan has been reviewed by 17 law enforcement agencies following the attempted assassination of former President Donald Trump. Additionally, Chicago Police Superintendent Larry Snelling says their plans also include ensuring there are enough officers to patrol the city.
And we're looking at our manpower, we're looking at our allocations, and we want to make sure, and we will make sure, that the neighborhoods who need us the most, we will be there.
And for more security plans for the DNC, you can visit our website. And a vacant site on the south side is being transformed into a massive hub for advanced computing. You heard right. State and city officials announced they are partnering with California-based company PsiQuantum that plans to build the largest quantum computing facility on the former Southwark Steel site. Quantum computers can solve more complex problems than supercomputers and much faster, according to the World Economic Forum.
Today, we bring ourselves a step closer to our quantum future, opening up a world of possibilities in everything from climate solutions to national security to healthcare and beyond. And in doing so, we are bringing jobs and opportunity and are laying the groundwork, the foundation for a long-term, broad-based economic prosperity for the state of Illinois.
The company says it expects the facility to create at least 150 jobs in the next 5 years. Up next, a look at CPS budget for the upcoming school year. That's right after this.
Chicago Tonight, Latino Voices, is made possible in part by the support of these donors.
Chicago's Board of Education unanimously approves the district's nearly $10 billion spending plan today. But critics of the budget say the district is relying on staff vacancies to plug its $505 million funding gap. WTTW News reporter Matt Masterson joins us now with more. Now, Matt, give us all the details. Tell us what challenges CPS was faced with while organizing the budget for the upcoming school year and how they decided to handle that. Mm-hmm.
So CPS already faced a nearly $400 million deficit because COVID funding from the federal government was set to run out this year. Over the last few months and weeks, they've run into additional cost issues from health care and special education costs that brought another $100 million onto that tab, bringing it up to, as you said, $505 million. CPS CEO Pedro Martinez today said the goal was to keep those cuts that they needed to balance this budget out of the classroom. So they tried to rely instead on reductions to central academic and operational budgets, grant funding, and they relied on increased vacancy savings, which is part of the issue that has been raised by the Chicago Teachers Union and other groups. The district says this is a balanced budget, but there were concerns raised about the long-term viability of the district's finances if they're not able to find other financial revenue streams in years coming. So the cuts were enough to get through this year, but there could be bigger problems on the horizon in future years.
As we know, there's been many opinions. Outside groups have weighed in on the budget, including the Chicago Teachers Union, who focused much of their concern on the staff vacancies in the district. Let's take a listen.
In this budget, CPS chose cuts and overcrowded classrooms instead of trying to find creative funding solutions to get us closer to being a transformative school district.
The board has its own equitable funding formula, right? They've stopped student-based budgeting. They say they want to give more into the classroom. How do you do that if you're cutting paraprofessionals? How do you do that if you're cutting restorative justice personnel?
Matt, what other concerns are there?
So the union, as they said, they were not happy about the number of staff vacancies. CPS says that it's actually bringing in more employees for the next school year. But the problem that the union has is that they're cutting aides and paraprofessionals who could assist in classroom settings. Educators and staffers who spoke today, they said that this budget is balanced on the back of those educators who are losing their jobs, having their positions cut. And as I said, there are concerns that remain about the future of CPS's finances. The district says that they're owed more than $1 billion in state funding from Illinois under its equitable funding formula. And CPS also has to cover hundreds of millions of dollars in teacher pension costs that are typically covered by the state for other school districts around Illinois. Both the district and the teachers union know that more funding is necessary for Chicago. Without it, district officials said today that their budgetary deficits could exceed $1 billion in the next 5 to 6 years.
That's a lot of money. What happens from here?
Yeah. So they need to continue working on that. They've been working in Springfield trying to get that funding from the state, but it hasn't been an easy process. Both the union and CPS officials have gone there together and try to put up a unified front, but they haven't got that money. So it's going to be a continued process to try to get any other funding they can from the state or otherwise.
Well, thank you, Matt, for that update.
Yeah, thanks, Joanna.
We're back with more right after this. Violence is an ongoing threat in Chicago's neighborhoods. So far this year, the Chicago Police Department reports 321 people have been killed. Many victims leave behind loved ones who are left to cope with the aftermath. But a local organization is helping families through the grieving process.
Se llevaba la bocina y se ponía a bailar ahí en el centro.
¿En el centro?
Sí, en el centro. Se ponía él solito. Se ponía a bailar ahí en el centro.
¿En el centro solo?
No le daba vergüenza.
This is Gilbert Hernandez, breakdancing for a quinceañera.
Por mí fue que yo le decía que jugara fútbol, pero no, ya después él no le gustó.
No le gustó.
No, ya.
Sí, él quería Él tenía un sueño de tener su propio estudio.
Gilbert was 21 years old when he was shot and killed. His sister, Iris Hernandez, says it's a heartbreak you never get over.
Not being able to come into his room and share any news with him or have a good cry with him. And it's more so of just feeling that absence now in the house and that quiet that doesn't go away.
The family has been receiving support from Chicago survivors for the past 2 years. The organization offers a range of free services to victims of violence, from counseling to legal aid.
Fue la única organización que ha estado con nosotros al pendiente y sigue estando con nosotros.
Gilbert's parents and prosecutors say he was shot multiple times by two men who stole his car. Iris says the organization's criminal justice unit is helping them through the court case, as two men have now been charged with his death.
If it wasn't for them, we would have been lost. We wouldn't have been connected with other mothers and families that recognize the pain and our understanding of what this process is like. And it would have been very confusing as well to go through the legal process of what the courts are, what is going on.
Chicago Survivors was founded in 2010. The executive director, Deshaun Hill, began as a social worker, driven by the loss of her brother to gun violence.
It's really a fire from within me because my brother and his life was worth what I see today. And I get to relive the good times, and I get to relive what it means to be about a response to violence when it wasn't there for me.
Hill says the organization partners with the Chicago Police Department by responding to homicide scenes and providing immediate support. Rosalba Alvarado is also receiving services. Her son was killed last year.
He had just left the house.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He came to drop some stuff, and a minute later, I heard the gunshots.
On November 26, 2023, 19-year-old Antonio Alvarado was fatally shot just a block away from his mother's home. Hill is making a home visit.
Tell me about him as a person and some of the things you would want us to know in the world outside of this other story, like, because he's bigger than that story.
My son was real imperactive.
Mm-hmm.
I had to be on top of him.
Mm-hmm.
But he was one who gathered us all.
Helping family members feel heard is what Hill says Chicago Survivors is providing.
He started before he was 18.
Why did he tell you he wanted to join?
He likes helping people.
Rosalba says her son was embracing a new life, working to better himself when he was killed, leaving behind a daughter he never got to meet.
It's hard. I'm supposed to be the strongest person in the family.
I was thinking, yeah.
You know, I do have other six kids. It's just like, how can you take that pain away from your kids?
Rosalba and her children are currently in therapy through the organization.
We can provide some practices, some ideas, but really the creativity of healing is individual. It's like, what works for you? And we're here as a bridge as Chicago Survivors to help you figure that out, find your way, and let you know you don't have to do it alone.
The Hernandez family say they found healing by creating an organization in honor of Gilbert.
I want people to know that my brother was truly the light in our life, which is why we decided to name the nonprofit La Luz Eterna de Gilbert, and in English we call it Jules Light. His dancing name is Jules, and it was given to him to reflect the way that he was a jewel to all the people that knew him.
Through Chicago Survivors, they have collaborated with other groups to organize events for children and teenagers who are passionate about breakdancing.
Nos ayuda mucho, es como una terapia, como revivir a su memoria, hacer lo que, haciendo lo que a él le gustaba. Y sé que él está feliz, porque es lo que él soñaba, lo que él quería.
And I want to thank these families for sharing their stories. For more on Chicago Survivors, you can visit our website. Up next, a new report shows a disturbing trend in domestic violence.
Chicago Tonight's coverage of public safety is supported by the Su Ling Jin Charitable Foundation Initiative for Reducing Violence in Chicago.
Advocacy groups are sounding the alarm on a spike in domestic violence cases. A new report from the Illinois Coalition Against Domestic Violence says domestic violence deaths in Illinois rose by 110% last year. The coalition says there were 94 incidents of domestic violence that led to 120 deaths in 2023. That's up from the previous year when there was 45 incidents and 57 deaths. The spike has advocates once again pushing for the passage of a bill in Springfield called Karina's Bill. Joining us now with more are Carmen Navarro, Executive Clerk of Court Operations for Administration and External Affairs at the Clerk of the Circuit Court of Cook County, and Baltasar Enriquez, Director of the Little Village Community Council. And joining us via Zoom, Vicki Smith, former Executive Director and Consultant for the Illinois Coalition Against Domestic Violence. Thank you all for joining us. Now, these, Vicki, I want to start with you. These numbers are very alarming. And as we know, usually the annual report is out in October. Why was it so important to release it early?
I think it was really important for us to get this information out as soon as we could, because there has been such a dramatic spike in the number of deaths across the state this year compared to last year and previous years. We've seen the numbers go up and down a little bit over the many years that we've done this report, but never such a dramatic increase in one year. And as you can see, when you read the report, a lot of those, most of those homicides were committed by guns. And so we really feel like we need to spend some time this summer going into October, Domestic Violence Awareness Month, to make sure that the public is aware of how dangerous domestic violence can be, and that we have resources and solutions to help people who are experiencing domestic violence.
And Baltasar, as I just mentioned, according to the report, 68% of those deaths were caused by firearms, including the fatal shooting of Carolina Gonzalez and her 15-year-old daughter, Daniela Alvarez, last year. Now, these murders took place in the Little Village community. Can you tell me a little bit about what was that feeling like in the community? What has been the community reaction?
So Carolina lived right around the corner of our office. And when it happened, we ran down to the house and we saw, you know, the red tape. And we questioned where did we fail, right? Our advocacy group, Las Valientes, started in 2022 when they found the bodies of Cristina Aical from Guatemala, 20 years old. And then 2 weeks later, we find Rosa Chacon, So from there, we've been asking the state for femicide charges, feminicidio, femicide. We're the only country in the world that doesn't have femicide charges. So we're asking for an attachment to the murder. If you murder a woman, you will have an attachment of femicide, right? And when Karina had already obtained order of protection, the law is already there. It says that when they obtain an order of protection, the state police is supposed to go pick up that gun. If the state police can do it, the Cook County Sheriff. If the Cook County Sheriff can do it, the domestic unit in the police department.
So the law failed her.
Yes. They were there 3 days prior, and they could have retrieved the gun, and they didn't, and that's why Karina's not here. But if they would, she was still alive. And the problem is that nobody got held accountable.
And Carmen, I want to bring you in. Karina's bill, named, as we know, in honor of Karina Gonzalez, would allow law enforcement to remove guns from accused abusers while serving orders of protection. Now, you have a background in law enforcement. Where does the bill stand now?
So where it stands right now, it was halted. There were a lot of things that people wanted to add at the end. I know they're saying there's a lot with law enforcement kind of pushing back on some things because they're stating they don't have the resources. But I think one thing that's really important is that we don't want victims out there to feel that like there's nothing in place right now. As Baltazar stated, there are laws already on the books that remove firearms from the hands of domestic abusers. The issue, I think, lies in the simple thing like what we're doing here today, which is educating people on what everyone's role is when it comes to domestic violence, because the system is failing. It is not just law enforcement. It is not just the advocates. It is not just the legislature. It's the fact that we're not all sitting together in the same space, understanding all of our roles so that we can save these women and their families.
Would you say that's why they need to pass this law?
That's why they need to pass this law. Absolutely.
And Vicky, going back to you, there's also an increase in the number of counties across Illinois where domestic deaths were reported, with Cook County showing the highest number of incidents. Why is this also alarming to you?
Well, Cook County, of course, has the highest population of Illinois, but we want to show that this is not unique to large urban areas. This is across the state, in our rural areas, in our suburban areas. It's something we have to address statewide, collectively, with all the as the previous speaker just mentioned, all our systems are not working together. And we have got to show that this isn't just a big city problem. It's a statewide problem. And we more counties this year than ever, 27 counties in Illinois experienced at least one domestic violence homicide. So we need to not look at this as some kind of localized issue. This is a statewide problem that we need to address. And that's why the state legislation is so important.
And Carmen, talk to me about the Domestic Violence Survivor Center in Markham. This was opened last October.
Yeah, it was opened last October. And from October through till present, we've helped over 1,500 people with file orders of protection. It's a safe space. Iris Martinez, the clerk of the circuit court, when she came in, she wanted us to identify spaces within our current facilities that wouldn't cost any money. We wouldn't have to go through any red tape. Because she was visiting a courthouse, and as she was walking through, there was a victim in the hall, bruised and battered, and she was speaking to the advocate in the hallway, and she found that unacceptable. So she charged us with finding space so that advocates can have a space, the children can have a quiet space, watch some TV, play, have a snack, and there'd be resources available. They can zoom into their court hearing. Even if their court hearing is not at the Markham Courthouse, it's in Skokie or Rolling Meadows, we have a Zoom room set up in that space, which is very helpful. We have our staff there, provide them the forms, help them complete the forms.
What has the feedback been like for the victims?
Well, it's been difficult. Again, going back to communication and everyone working together, everyone gets comfortable doing things the way they've always done it. There are some advocates who have been great about utilizing the space. There's other advocates who want to continue using the space they're in. And so we can create the space. We can make the space available. The victims utilize the space. We don't always get all the advocates into
So it's really bringing
space.
Everybody together.
It's bringing everyone together.
In Baltazar, last year, your organization held a march against domestic violence in Little Village. Can you tell me about the event? And as a man, why is it so important for you to stand up for this?
Well, you know, I'm a big mama boy, so my mom raised me, and I always saw the way that in my life this played a role. Domestic violence played a role. My parents got separated when I was 14. I then became the head of the household. I, the bread maker, and that's what happens here, right? The family breaks up, and the kids become the victim too. So I became the victim, and I skipped my youth. I became to work, became an adult at 14. And so these are the things that our community faces, the children growing up in the community. And how do we break that cycle, right, of me not becoming an abuser? So I think my mother taught me that women are the ones that are caring for you, raising you. And I think the love that she gave me is what is making me fight for women's rights, fight for them to have.
Are you surprised with the spike in deaths?
Yes, it's shocking, to see this number go so high. So we have to see that there is an issue with the aggressor, and that the aggressor also needs mental health services instead of being incarcerated, instead of just being put in jail, and they come out more angry, more aggressive.
Trying to break the system.
And, yes.
And Carmen, last question here. You dedicated much of your career to preventing domestic violence. What would you tell someone who's facing, these domestic violence, who's a victim? What would you tell them?
The system itself has to be victim-driven. And I would tell them, first of all, we all need to admit that we are failing victims every day. And by we, it's the system. And so please don't lose hope. Someone somewhere may have failed, but there's always help. Speak up. Let us know who failed you, where you were failed, so that we can shore that up and really protect you and help you. And there are spaces. There are a lot of people doing this work. Vicky's been at it forever.
I'm sorry. We're gonna have to leave it at that. But thank you, everybody, for your input.
Thank you, Mariana.
Absolutely.
Back with more right after this. Long before the ancient civilizations of the Aztecs or the Mayas, there were the Olmecs. Their people once lived along the southeast border of Mexico in what is now Veracruz, and are considered one of the most influential civilizations of Mesoamerica. Now, a symbol of their legacy, the Olmec head, is at the center of a public art project on display across the Chicago area.
The Olmec are the first civilization, dicen la madre cultura, because they're finding out, anthropologists in the know, they find out that this civilization is kind of what inspired a lot of the Aztecs, the Mayans, everything around, after they started moving, migrating from the areas that they did. And then they, the way we were found out about them was because of these gigantic stone heads. It's very important to understand that they found rubber, the cacao, corn, They gave us a lot of things that we start now to look into, and we say these are the things that we are just very common day for us.
So this project for me means quite a bit. It means a lot because it allows me to look back into the ancient cultures of Mexico, into my own culture growing up in Mexico, and kind of looking back at it, remembering some of the stories that I learned. My piece at the Olmec Trails, looks at the idea of cycles of life, which, the paint drips, the paint flows. So to me, that's the aspect of rain. And rain is an aspect in the cycle of the earth, right? And all the ancient cultures looked at cycles. They were ruled, and they were, all about the cycles of the earth, the cycles of the moon, of the stars. They studied those things. And that, for me, is an important part of my work. There's an actual line that you can follow around the head, which starts in the back of the head in the map of Mexico, and in particularly in the region where the Olmec heads were found. And it ends at the top of the head in the frontal area, or the forehead, of the head, of the Olmec head. So the trail begins in the past and it ends with the present. One of the most important parts of the project that really attracted me was also that most of the artists, we were invited to go and work on site with other artists, and that enriched me as an artist, as I worked on my piece, being in community of others. And I think that was one of the important elements of the project, I feel, is that sense of community that was created, with the different groups that worked together, some in Mexico, some here in the United States. And that was, I think, a really fascinating and exciting thing for us as artists, you know, to remember, you know, the conversations and the friendships that were made during that time.
It's a great entry point for the culture, the art, and even where it's placed. You know, it's something important to somebody because, you know, again, they've been traveling by there for a long time in their life, or maybe they're new to the place and they just saw it. Who knows? But it's always a great experience. So we try to find these little windows and find ways to kind of connect people. At the end of the day, we want them to learn about Mexico.
You can also check out the history of the Olmecs exhibit on display at the College of DuPage. For more details on the entire project, you can visit our website. And that's our show tonight. Join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 7 for the weekend review. And from all of us here at Chicago Tonight, Latino Voices, I'm Joanna Hernandez. Stay healthy, stay safe, y buenas noches.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a personal injury law firm dedicated to preserving the dignity and rights of all individuals.